started. I'm Larry Collins. Can you hear me all right?
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. I'm a geologist. I've got over 50 years of experience either teaching or out in the field as a geologist. So if you see me around the village and have a question about rocks, I have rocks in my head. If I don't know the answer, I can at least tell you a story that sounds believable. Okay. The slides that I'm going to show you today are taken by Clifford Hobson. They're not my own. He did his PhD thesis on Mount St. Helens. And when the eruption occurred, National Geographic contacted him as a consultant for the article that they did on it. But he had such a marvelous set of slides of what happened that I said, can I have a duplicate set? And he gave them to me, and I'm going to share that with you. I may not have right answers on some of the things that you will see, but I'll do the best I can. This is Mount St. Helens in 1975. This is Spirit Lake here in the foreground. Back in here is somewhere is the lodge of Harry Truman, who lived there and decided that he wouldn't leave before the eruption occurred. He said that I'll either live or die here, and so he didn't leave. But you can see some Douglas fir trees there, some of which are they're mature trees, some of which have trunks that are 7 feet in diameter. So that'll give you some idea. Next. Okay, prior to the eruption, this is a record of earthquakes, more than 3 per hour, starting in March, progressively through April to May. And the first eruption occurred at this point. The earthquakes give you a signal that something is on its way up. And it's this point where the first eruption occurs, and I will show you that eruption. And then there is periodic earthquakes progressively all up to the May 18th, and this is when the giant explosion occurred. Okay? At any rate, each of those eruptions that indicate that something's moving up, breaking the rock, and causing a seismic rupture. Next. Okay, this is the first eruption. And that's the one that I showed you on the diagram there. That occurred on, March 29th, 1980. And when that eruption occurred, next slide. It melted a hole through the snow and the ice and the glacier up at the summit, and this is where that all that ash and cinders came out at that point. Next slide. And then it developed into 2 craters at the top, so it found more openings along a fracture up there where the ash and cinders could come out. Next slide. And one of the later eruptions in this early stage, you had a lot of ash and pumice blown out, and it came out as hot steam and down the slope here. Next slide. And you can see it's on its way down. If you happen to be at the bottom of that, you probably would not survive because the temperatures would be hot steam, 800 degrees or whatever, and you'd suffocate from that. Anyway, this is part of some of the early eruptions. Next. In those early eruptions, there was some ash and cinders blown out, and some of that ash and cinder had landed on top of the glaciers here, and you can see some landslides and ice blocks that have slid down because of the earthquakes that were causing the whole mountain to shake, and so it was breaking loose some of this material, and that's what you see here. Next. Okay. Eventually, that double crater developed into a much larger hole here where the stuff is being blown out. And you're beginning to develop a collapse structure here in which this part of the crater is beginning to open up. The stuff coming up is causing the mountain to expand. And as it expands, the upper part of it is collapsing down into a hole. Next. And here, looking on the face view of it, this area right here began to form a bulge. You see magma, the lava, the steam that was coming up was beginning to lift the face of the mountain, causing it to bulge out from the face of it that you see right here. And it's beginning to develop a crack along the fracture there of a scarp, where it's going to break totally loose during the eruption. Next. And this gives you some idea of what's happening in terms of a sketch as a profile view. The upper part here begins to drop down to open up a crater. The side of the mountain begins to push out progressively with time from what you see there in August 1979, a dotted line. In April, it's beginning to push away from there, and in May, it's pushing away so much that the side of the mountain is getting oversteepened. Because of its oversteepening, it was unstable, and part of this mountain then broke loose as a large landslide. Next slide. Okay, this shows you again a face view, and the place where it's going to break, first of all, is about right in here along a fracture system. In this part, it's being formed a large bulge on the side of the mountain, getting oversteepened. It's suddenly going to break loose, and there's going to be a 2,000-foot cliff there. And then later, this part up here breaks loose, and that part slides down. So you have two major landslides that occur. This one occurring first, and that one second. And what you have to picture now is that, imagine this volcano being a 7-Up bottle under pressure. You can't see the carbon dioxide that's dissolved in the water that's there and the fluids that make it nice and sweet, but it's there under pressure. Now, if I were to put that 7-Up bottle on a stove and heat it, you can imagine things are going to get rather dangerous. And if you were to suddenly break the cap of the 7-Up bottle, you would get a frothing out of all of the carbon dioxide blowing bubbles into that. You agree with me? Okay. Well, what's happening here underneath this volcano is steam is working its way up. It's under high pressure. It's superheated steam. And when the mountainside breaks loose and slide down and you remove the cap on it, 1 cubic centimeter of that steam will expand into 540 cubic centimeters.
Wow.
Boom! See? Suddenly you've got so much energy there, it's literally going to blow that whole mountain up. Next slide. And the people here were about a month before the eruption noticed that this was going on, and they had a little sense of humor, and they said, look, St. Helens is alive and well, and they weren't terribly worried about it. Next slide. But then it happened on that date where it suddenly exploded, and this is a report from the San Francisco Chronicle. The eruption killed 5 people in a giant ash cloud, and now we're going to look at what happened during this explosion. Next. All right. We're looking here at this part here that's going to slide down suddenly, and then later this is the part that comes down. Next. All right. Here's where that part broke loose. There's the 2,000-foot cliff of that slide. Okay. And this one up here hasn't broken loose yet. But this is the first landslide. We're breaking the cap on the 7-Up bottle, releasing the pressure. Next. Now that we've released it, you can see down here in the lower right somewhere, I think gas is starting to come out from the side. I can't see where I am. And here you're beginning to see the first eruption of the break at the upper part where it explodes and goes vertically upward. So we have a lateral blast and a vertical blast. The next slide. And this is a different view from another photographer. And here's the beginning of the lateral blast right here. Here's where the upper slide is just beginning to go, and there's the vertical eruption starting to come up. Everybody see it okay? Next slide. All right, now you're going to see a sequence of photos of what happens. Here comes the lateral blast out here. Here becomes the vertical blast out here. And this is the second part that's breaking loose and causing a landslide. Next slide. All right. And as this comes out here, then all the rock in the second slide is being torn apart and blown out and thrown out as a huge mass of rock over there, down into the canyon. Okay, next slide. All right. And this comes up with a nice big roar. Next slide. All right, there's a somebody in a books, now the books on a station wagon on a Hopcup view place about 12 miles away. And he was taking pictures of this, all that you see that was happening there. And he was watching the sequence of this, taking pictures, pictures, pictures. I'll show you the sequence. And he and another person was also taking from a different view and watching it come. And here we go. Next slide. Next slide. Suddenly he's beginning to realize that maybe he isn't in the same spot. And he jumped into his car and started to race down the mountain to get away from this thing. All right? Next slide. And it's getting pretty dangerous looking. Next slide. And he's getting so close, the pumice and ash are raining down out of this cloud. And fortunately, where he got to was a place where there was a ridge and this blast went around on both sides of him. Otherwise he would not have survived. That's how lucky he was. All right, next slide. This is a view from another place during the eruption. One of the early eruptions of that volcano from a site, I think the USGS had a observation station. It turns out that one of the men that was there traded jobs with another person who came into this particular site, and the man that left and traded off survived, and the man that came in to take his place got killed the next day. Next slide. All right. This is a satellite view from about 22,000 miles away. And this is about, maybe a few hours after the eruption. There is the black cloud there. The diameter of this is about 30 miles. You can see the outline of Washington, Idaho, Montana, Oregon in here. So you can see where this thing is. This area is now beyond the blowdown zone of the trees that are blown down, which I will show you in a little bit. Slide. This is about an hour and 45 minutes later. You can see it expanding, and there's a steam cloud here that's condensing. It's beginning to drift out away from this spot. Next slide. I think this is about 5 hours later. It's now beginning to expand down in this direction here. Next slide. Now it's expanded over into Idaho, and I think if I may have one more here that's 8 hours later. Next slide. Yes. 8 hours later, you can see that it's expanded all the way down to here in terms of the ash and material that's blown up high up into the atmosphere and then blown eastward by this process. Next slide. Okay, when that ash and stuff was blown out, here's where the crater is. This is an isopach map of the thickness of the ash. And out here, there's no ash. That's zero boundary. There's 1 foot, 2 foot, 3 feet, 4 feet, up to 7 feet in this area. And I think this goes up from 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, or 9. I guess it's up to 8 feet thick, right next to where the volcano is. And this is the ash that's deposited out over in Idaho, less than a foot, but at least blown out in that area. Next slide. Okay, if you lived in Yakima, Washington, after this earthquake, and this eruption, there was so much ash blown out on tops of the rooftops and yards and driveways, and here's somebody using a snow shovel to help shovel off this. This ash. The ash is quite white. It's because it's a very siliceous ash. The magma probably had about almost 60-65% silica in it, and it when you blow bubbles in this stuff, it's very frothy and it's loose and white. And this, it looks like snow, except it gets into car engines and doesn't make them run very well. Next slide. Okay, so this is a picture of a sketch of what the mountain used to look like, approximate scale of the dimension. Here's what happened after the earthquake in terms of how much was blown out. All this rock and debris here was blown out into space, down into the canyons and avalanche zone, which I will show you. This is the dog's head over here for a reference point. At any rate, this is the volume of rock that got blown out from the force of that violent eruption. Okay. After the eruption, you could look into the crater here and you can see a warm lava coming up and forming a dome in here, the steam arriving up, and then there was a later eruption after this. I'll show you that later on. Next. Okay, this is a sketch, again, to repeat what I said, in case it wasn't clear the first time. That is, you start with a volcano, which has that shape. You then cause steam rising up in here, superheated steam, which is causing the rock to melt. And the mount coming up here causes the mountainside to expand and to cause a bulge to push out at that side and an opening. A graben, a drop down zone occurs, opening up a crater up here at the top because of this expansion. Okay? And the bulge comes out here, pushing out, and then eventually you get it so oversteepened that during a earthquake of 5 points on the Richter scale, that shook it enough to create enough break the friction on the side of that bulge there, and this is where the 2,000-foot landslide occurred. And from out of there came the horizontal blast, and then from here went up the vertical blast. So you can see how this material is blown out and what the sequence is for this to erupt. Next slide. Okay, this is a view by Clifford Hobson from the top of Mount St. Helens when he was doing his thesis. And he's looking down towards Spirit Lake here in the foreground, over toward Mount Rainier in the background. And this ridge here caught the full effect of the blast. And Harry Truman had a lodge somewhere on the border, I don't know just where, in the trees right there. And you're looking down on this lovely landscape, and I don't know whether anybody visited this area before. You have, okay. You maybe have seen how beautiful that lake is, but this is prior to the eruption. Next slide. Okay, this is looking from the same spot, looking toward Mount Rainier in the background. Here is Spirit Lake. Harry Truman's Lodge is somewhere underneath there. You can see lots of floating logs on the lake here from the eruption. The blast went over the top of that ridge and stripped the trees, and we'll show you that in a moment. Next slide. Okay, this is the outer limit of the blast. This is the singe zone. It is the hot steam went by right here, and it killed the trees, and you can see the beginning of the blast zone of the trees that got knocked down, but that's the limit of the blast right there. Mm-hmm. Next slide. And now you can see a portion, I think this is Elk Lake here, and you can see the blowdown of all the trees from the blast as it went there. Trees that had trunks 7 feet in diameter and broken like matchsticks. Next picture. All right. There's where they're broken off like matchsticks. Those are tree trunks, some of which are 4 or 5 feet in diameter. Trees literally stripped off by the force of this blast. Next slide. There's an idea how much force, and this is ash that's deposited around the base of the tree trunk. Okay. Next slide. All right.
do this without looking at my notes or turning my flashlight off.
This is the dog's head over here. This is the part that got blown out. All of this area got blasted out here, and these are the mature trees that got stripped off there. Next slide. And that's the area that got blown out now. You see all these trees here have been stripped away. I think this is the dog's head right over here, and this is the crater, and all of this area has been totally stripped of those big trees. Next slide. This was where the USGS geologist was at his observation station. Not much chance for him to survive. It literally blasted off everything. Next. Okay, here's Spirit Lake. There's some tour trees along here. Here's where the lodge was that Harry Truman decided he'd stay. And we're going to look at this area. Let's see what the next picture is. I'll remember. This is looking down from the lodge area, down valley. And you can see the Spirit Lake here, the trees are floating here, and there's later eruption of pumice from a later eruption on top of the avalanche material. And you can see pocketed areas where the heat of the eruption heated up the streams and the lakes and the groundwater there to steam, and the steam then burst its way up through the ash and moved pockets into the ash on the top of it. Okay, next slide. All right, again, a view. I think this is the dog's head or somewhere here, and this is the part that got blasted out, and we're going to look at this ridge right here with all the trees on it and see what happened to it. Next slide. This is the lee side of the blast, and you can see the trees that were on there. I'm going to show you the back side of this ridge that received the full force of the blast. Okay, next slide. It was so powerful that it stripped everything down to bedrock. There's no trees left there, and now we have a snowstorm and it's a snow beast eating marshmallows in it. All right. Anyway, you can see the stratification of layers here, all the trees and the trunks, and everything's gone. It's just been blasted right off of it. Next slide. Okay, the green area shows the blowdown area. So it extends out here. I'm guessing that the person that survived was somewhere on this ridge on either side, and the blast zone went on both sides of them. So those people who were taking pictures managed to race to that spot. Managed to survive. But the blast went way out here. This is Spirit Lake right here. The pink area is an avalanche zone that extended some 17 or so miles down this valley here to Camp Baker. I'll show you some pictures near back to Camp Baker. The orange area is the pumice that later landed on top of the avalanche debris. Next slide. This is some of the avalanche debris. There are huge blocks of ice here from the glacier. Everything that got blown out of that huge area that was evacuated by this blast got dumped down this valley. In some places it's more than 400 feet deep. Others are 200, and it just got blown right out of that mountain. Next slide. Here you can see a large block of ice, part of the glacier that got dumped out here as part of that avalanche debris. Next slide. This is down in the river valley here. You can see blocks of ice, blocks of rock in here that just got blasted out. Next slide. And then here's the pumice on top with some pocket holes where steam had come up through the top of the avalanche itself. Next slide. And here's some of the pumice. Now, pumice is just frothed up rock. I don't know whether you've ever seen obsidian. Anybody have seen obsidian before that's like black glass?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's solidified lava that's got in it. If you froth it up with the steam bubbles, it'll be white. And it'll look frothy white. If you crystallize it at a great depth down in the crust 5 or 6 miles, it forms coarse crystals, and it might be granite. It's the same stuff, it's just the condition of what you're looking at. If it cools very quickly, you will freeze the lava as a glass. If you cool it slowly and it's time for crystals to grow, some of you have made jam and stored it in a basement somewhere and you're going to use it, but you forget about it for 20 years and you come back and you open the jam and it's got sugar crystals in it this large. Over time, the sugar realigns itself in the form of large crystals. If you give enough time, you can grow large crystals. But if you cool it very quickly, you've got smooth jam. Okay? So if you allow the same molten material consisting of a certain composition to cool slowly, it's time for the atoms to slowly move in and make the right places to make large crystals. If you cool it very quickly, then you get smaller crystals, and very fast, and you get a glass. Blow a lot of steam into it, you'll froth it up and make pumice. All of it is the same stuff, but it's the condition of crystallization as to what you see. And that black obsidian that you see maybe has only 3% iron in it, but it stains the glass like you get stained glass, okay? And that iron that would go into the granite will form the biotite mica. All right, everybody get a picture now? All right, next slide. Okay, after the blast, there was so much hot water coming out of here that it washed out a lot of the pumice and formed a mud slide. And the mud slide went down the north fork of the Total River down this way. The mud flow came down the south fork of the Total River, came all the way down here, came into the Cowlitz River, and all the way down toward the Columbia River right here. Going to show you a sequence of photos from Castle Rock, working our way back up here to wherever Camp Baker is. Anybody see where?
To the right.
Here somewhere.
A little
further. Oh, yeah, there's Baker. Okay, we're going to work our way through this mud flow that can, I think it may have flowed all the way some 60 miles down this canyon. All right, next slide. This is down near the Cowlitz River, where it comes into Castle Rock. And some of these places in there are houses that are buried up almost to the rooftops by the mud flow that comes down. Okay. Next slide. Here is a highway bridge road that was completely knocked out by mud flow. I'm thinking that white mark there and there is the height of the mud flow when it first went by. That's the high water mark. So it just really, this mass of pumice and rock, a lot of energy come down there, just shoved and broke everything and destroyed the bridge that you see there. Next slide. And again, you can see all the debris that's carried down there. And in the background, you can see the trees with the high water mark when that mud flow came through and it drained out all this area and the present level was here. But it once came through at that level. Next slide. This is a railroad bridge.
Wow.
Carried some 2 miles from its former place by the mud flow, and obviously it's totally destroyed. Next slide. This is at Camp Baker. That is a lumber truck, and it's wrapped around a tree. I don't think very many people would survive in that one if they got out of there, had a warning to get out, so next slide. All right, after the eruption, then you had more lava coming in and starting to build up a dome inside of here, and the pressure began to build up with the steam, and you've got another eruption occurred later after the main blast. Next slide. And you can see the process of building up of that dome. It's a very viscous lava, it's very glassy and forms a plug over there. Next slide. and this is a little close up here, a little bit too close, and you're not sure whether it's going to blast or not until the helicopter got out of there. Next slide. At any rate, there is the eruption of the second eruption, and it's releasing that steam pressure again, blowing ash and cinders up into the atmosphere. And here's the next picture. And most of that is steam, not ash, and it's gone up to 60,000 feet in the atmosphere. Next slide. This is about a month later, it was still erupting, and ash, this steam cloud was here about 45,000 feet high up in the atmosphere. Next slide. And then after that, it quieted down, and inside of that larger bulbous dome that was had the eruption, we had a new dome beginning to form here, and I don't think that one finally released any pressure and it didn't erupt. But you can see the lava was still trying to come up, and we're releasing all the pressure down below. Thanks. Okay, and that's just a close-up of that little tiny dome. I'm guessing this is about 200 feet across here to give you some idea scale. Next slide. Okay, here is a picture of a similar eruption in 1956 in Russia to show you this happens around the world. And this was a much larger eruption than Mount St. Helens. And this is a dome that was beginning to build up, and this one to release pressure and so on. But there are some enormous eruptions worldwide that are even larger than this one that periodically happen. Geologically. Next slide. This is a view of an eruption in 1978 of an andesite flow. This was much earlier. And the eruption, and you can see that there's periodic eruptions over time. The volcano will sit dormantly for a while, but then as the pressure builds up with the steam coming up, and you get these kinds of eruptions. Next slide. And inside the crater, you can see layers of volcanic material here of ancient times of this eruption. Indian legends tell about the eruptions of this thing back in time. But we know that this thing goes off once every 300 or 400 years, and there are records of it. And it just takes time to build up the pressure again. Next slide. Okay, I'm going to give you a short course in volcanology. There are essentially three different types of volcanoes. We call this type a shield volcano because it forms a large, flat-shaped structure. This is typical of the Hawaiian Islands, Mauna Loa, this area. Mauna Loa sticks up here about 15,000 feet. It's one of the highest mountains in the world because if we're taking the distance from the top of the mountain to the floor of the ocean, it's 30,000 feet. So this has been erupting over time, lots and lots of time, build this mountain up till finally it emerged above sea level and where we can see it, okay? And the lava that forms a shield volcano here is lava that is very low in silica, maybe 35 to 45%, and it's got a lot of calcium, magnesium, iron, sodium in it. Makes a very black lava. It comes out at high temperatures, 1100 to 1400 degrees centigrade. Because there's so little silica in it, it flows for miles. It's very fluid. The lava comes up and runs down these slopes and spreads out, so you make a shield type structure. All volcanoes start off with an eruption that releases the steam pressure. And once the steam is released, and if it's hot enough and fluid enough, the lava will come out and then run down the slope and make a shield structure. If the magma consists of, let's say, 55 to 65% silica and less amount of iron and magnesium and calcium in it, then you produce what is called a composite type volcano. The first
first part of the eruption releases the steam pressure and blows out pyroclastic material. That means just material that's come from hot temperatures, the ash and cinders, so that you get a cinder eruption first, and then the lava eventually comes out and runs down the slope, and it's not quite as flat. It makes a cone-shaped structure, and you alternate cinders with lava, and you repeat this over and over with time, and you develop this type of cone structure. Then if you start with a rock that is 65-70% silica, very silica rich, it's a lot. If you've ever seen an artisan blow glass or to make whatever bulbs or whatever you make glasses out of or whatever they make, I'm lost for words now. It's very thick and viscous stuff. Well, nature, when it's dealing with thick, viscous stuff, the magma there is so thick and viscous, I need to back up a little bit here. Before this top here, where the crack, this type of lava tends to come up a long crack. And when that high temperature lava cools, it contracts and makes cracks in the rock. So that this type of volcano in Hawaii, the cracks there allow the lava to punch its way through, and so eruptions in Hawaii happen every 4 or 5 years because the pressure doesn't build up very much. It can break its way through, the lava can run down the slope. This type of magma, the magma is so thick and viscous it doesn't contract very much, and so it forms a plug on the volcano, and this type of volcano tends to come up in a pipe rather than a longer crack. And that pipe gets plugged. And because it's plugged, and the steam can't break its way through, this type of volcano might sit for 500,000 years or so until the pressure builds up to the point where it literally blows the plug out. Okay? So it's a very different type of volcano. Mount St. Hood's is somewhere in between here. Okay? It has compositions in between this point, and so it's almost a composite type volcano. If you've seen, anybody seen columnar joining in Devil's Postpile or any of this columnar joining in basalt? When you go to some of these places where there's basalt lava flows, you'll often have columnar joints, and they are hexagonal in outline. The reason why they're hexagonal in outline is this thick lava flow that came out cools from the top down. The upper part begins to contract, and the most efficient way for the lava to contract is into a hexagonal shape. The reason why honeys belt their combs with hexagonal combs, they can get the most honey into a hexagonal shape. Okay? The lava can get its most efficient packing if it forms a hexagonal form, but it cools from the top down, and then hexagonal form cools progressively downward, and you end up with a hexagonal column. Okay?
Is Devil's Tower an example of that?
Okay, Devil's Tower is similar to this in that you have giant columns and it probably cooled from the top down, and the contraction developed that shape. But those are enormous joints there, and that's, but it's exactly what's happening. All right, I'm going to stop there and leave it for questions and what you'd like to ask, and hopefully I've explained this clearly that you understand.
Yep. Question, what are the greatest risks in the world from volcanoes right now?
All right, let me give you an example of an area like Mount St. Rainier. Mount St. Rainier, the U.S. Air Force flies once a month. They have heat sensors to go over the top Mount St. Rainier to find out is heat building up there, is something on its way up. Below Mount St. Rainier is a beautiful country for building. Real estate people would just love to build in there. But you can't let people build in there because of the potential for Mount St. Rainier to erupt. And we have enough records from dating on these things, and some of them erupt every 300 or 400 years, and we don't know when they're going to erupt again. It wasn't too long ago that Mount Baker was erupting. Mm-hmm. So we have a ring of fire all the way around the Pacific Ocean. And the reason is around the Pacific Ocean, the oceanic plates are diving underneath the continent because of continental drift and this sort of thing. And those oceanic plates bring salt water with it. And as the plate dives down underneath the ocean at a depth of about 100 kilometers below the surface, that speed, that water that's in that basalt that's carried down there, gets hot enough to cause the rock to melt. And so inland from the coast, this melted material then comes up to form the volcanoes. So we have a line of volcanoes, Mount Hood, Mount Rainier, what are the names of some of the others?
Three Sisters.
All of these are where presently the oceanic plate is diving underneath the continent. Well, as you go around the Pacific Ocean, the Aleutian Islands, Japan, all the way around South America, up the coast, you've got the Andes. The Andes have a lot of andesite volcanic rock in it. That's where they get the name, and these are volcanoes from this plate that's diving under and causing it. And the same thing happens in Turkey, wherever you got plates are diving underneath there. And Turkey has a Mount Ararat, where the supposed Moses Ark is supposed to land, is a volcanic peak where a plate was dug. One question. Yeah.
What did all the cities do with all the ash?
Oh, they just scraped it off and dumped it and hauled it away, as far as I know. But makes an excellent fertilizer, so a lot of their crops were really doing very well. And the available mineral matter.
Driving south on I-5, you can still see the hills of ash. They're now covered with, you know, greenery, but for a long time they were gray and piled up on the sides down between Castle Rock and Maumee.
If you walk through the village and the trails around here, occasionally you'll see an orangish rock, and if you pick it up, it's a pumice. It's very lightweight. That pumice came from Glacier Peak that way. It erupted about 6,000 years ago, blew all the pumice and ash, and it rained down through the forest and right here in Old Village. If you look for it, you'll see where the pumice happens from that eruption. More questions?
Is that why the tailings are orange?
Okay. He asked, why is it that the tailings are orange? Okay. High up on the mountainside, you can see older tailings up there. When Holden, who was an engineer, came here in the early 1920s, he was part of a survey team that came in with the Northwestern Railway. They were looking for a route to go through the mountains for the railway. Well, the railway company decided not to put it through here, and Holden had seen a stain of orange up on the side of the mountain and knew that there was an ore body up there, potentially. And he had gone up and sampled and found sphalerite, which is a zinc sulfur mineral, chalcopyrite, which is a copper iron sulfur mineral. It's about one third copper, one third iron, one third sulfur, and so he knew there was potential ore up there. And in the early 1920s, he went up there and tunneled into the side of the mountain. The ore zone is about 80 feet wide on the average. It dips into the mountain about a 65 degree angle. And he had found the outcrop at the top, and below that, he had tunneled into the mountain to pull out and high grade the ore zone. And that's because of the iron minerals that in there, the rock that came out, oxidized with the water and oxygen to make a rust. When the House Sound Company came in here, they went in at the 1,500-foot level, went into the mountain about 2,500 feet to intersect that ore zone, and then they put cores out and to find out how much was there. They found out that there was about 3% copper in the upper levels. It was a little bit lower in the lower levels, and it began to increase in value to about 3% in some of the deeper levels. At any rate, they put this tunnel into here, blasted the rock, and they spent about almost $5 million in the process of building these structures here and the mine structure before they even got anything out in terms of profit. And they would blast the rock crush it up with a crusher underground to try to get it down to 6 inches in size. And we bring it out to another crusher out here where the mill structure is to further grind it down to a powder. And we had to do this in order to get the disseminated chalcopyrite and sphalerite in the cracks and fractures out of that rock. At the top of the mill structure, they had tanks with water in it, which they fed chemicals in. And the chemicals were such that the quartz and the feldspar part of the rock up there that surrounded the ore minerals would float. And they would pump this as a slurry of mixtures of this fine powder of rock and of quartz and feldspar out into the tailings ground. That which didn't float sank down to a lower level. In this, they added more chemicals, which were such that if you added compressed air to it, it would make a suds. And it turns out the chalcopyrite would stick to the suds, and so they could skim off the suds and separate the chalcopyrite. But the sphalerite would not adhere to the suds and they'd sink to the bottom. And they could separate the two ore minerals. They would wash what was there, recover their chemicals to the best that they could, load the ore minerals up into the large vats that weighed 5 tons or so, each of them, load them on large trucks and take them down to Joanne and then out to the dock and finally out to the smelter in Tacoma. But in the rock that you see out here, there are still mica flakes that have iron in it, that have some magnetite minerals in it, which have iron in it. There's a bit of sphalerite, or a little bit of pyrite that goes out there, which is iron sulfide. It easily oxidizes to make a rust, so that's what makes everything a reddish-orange color. It's because of the oxidation of the iron, and when it first came out, it would have been white rather than this reddish color. It was probably initially, now with the ore, they took out about $600,000 ounces of gold at $35 an ounce. That was in addition to the copper. Mm-hmm. They took out, forgotten how many ounces of silver, and then they get both zinc and copper. I think they probably took out $100 million worth of ore out of the mountain up there. In the process of mining earlier, they could get everything by gravity feed from the upper levels. There are 7 levels above the main entrance level. That's a 1,500-foot level. And there are 6 levels below it. In the early stages, they could blast the ore by gravity feed, bring it down the mill. It didn't cost them any electrical energy. As they got below the 1,500-foot level, then they had to raise it using electrical energy to bring it up. And the deeper they went, the more costly it was to bring it up. And the reason why they had to shut the mine down was that in 1957 or June or so, the price of labor was going up, unions were getting active, wanting more pay. So transportation was going up, both the railways and the trucks to get the stuff down. The price of electricity went up. At this point, they were beginning to run out of ore that was easy to get, so they built a road up to the Ford Holden Lake. If you take the Holden Lake Trail, you'll blow up the whole road that they went up there to haul drilling equipment to project the ore body across the valley and put drill cores over there to see if they can find any ore over there. And if you take that trail up there along the road, you can see some holes in the rock there where they have drilled in. They didn't find anything. They then drilled a tunnel half a mile to a mile into Buckskin Mountain, which is the next mountain over, projecting the ore body in the hopes of finding an ore zone there, and they didn't find anything. So they were running out of places where they could get ore easily by gravity feed. If they had found anything in Holden, they would have strung lines over there and buckets and transported it over the mill from the side of the mountain over there. They didn't find anything. Final kicker was that that year in 57, the price of copper dropped from 46 cents a pound down to 23 cents a pound. Bingo. It wasn't ore anymore. And quit. There's no point in hauling the stuff out. There are several thousand tons of broken rock down at the 2300 and 2500 level, ready to come up. But there's no point in bringing it up because you don't make any money from it. So that's why they shut down. When they shut down, the company said, we're quitting, and the miners just couldn't believe it. They had such a happy life here, enjoyed themselves so thoroughly. They had raised family here for 20 years. And the company official said, we're closing down. And finally, they had to say, this is the last day. We're going to let you, any way that you can get out of the boat. If you don't get out now, you're on your own. And so they dawned on these people, uh-oh, we're in trouble. And I'm told that some of the miners left in such a hurry. They left clothes on the line, dishes of food on the plate to get on the boat to get down in order to get out. So give you an idea. Has anything to do with volcanoes, but I'm answering questions. I think we got another session coming in here at what time?
4:15. So we're done at 4.
I've got a little bit more if you want to ask. Well, if you see me around the village anywhere, ask me and I'll tell you stories.